If you are looking to elevate your leadership and drive your nonprofit forward, I invite you to subscribe to the Successful Nonprofits newsletter. Every week, I curate exclusive, shareworthy content that sparks inspiration, innovation, and conversation. From the latest trends to timeless advice, the weekly email newsletter is your all-access pass to a treasure trove of resources. But receiving the newsletter is not just about staying informed. It's also about getting our best content first. Subscribers get first access to our newest downloadable templates designed to propel your leadership and amplify your impact. And that's not all, my friend. We are constantly working on new ways to support you and your mission. So as a subscriber, you'll get updates on our latest projects, opportunities to participate in surveys, and a say in the topics that we tackle next. You will essentially get me as a consultant, coach, and confidant in your inbox, ready to help you navigate the challenges of nonprofit leadership. So if you're an executive director, board chair, or a nonprofit leader who believes in making a difference, join me as a newsletter subscriber. Visit successfulnonprofits.com/newsletter to sign up today. And now, friend, let me take you to the episode you've downloaded. Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. Friend, today's episode is a twofer. It's a twofer in that we have Tom Mosloom and Jason Absher coming on to talk to us about how we can make our logos not suck. Because let's face this, so often in the nonprofit sectors, our logos aren't good. I mean, they just aren't. So sometimes we'll either like have a volunteer make it, or even worse, like maybe one of our children or a relative will just try to throw a logo together for us. And there's so much that we expect from our logo, and it doesn't deliver any of that. And that's why when I saw an incredible blog post on the mnetwork.com that essentially its title was something like, "Nonprofits have terrible logos." I read it. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, these people, they're right on. They 100% get the issues that nonprofits are having with their logos. And so me not being shy reached out and I was like, oh my gosh, can we get you on the podcast? And so I am so excited that Jason and Tom are joining us. Tom is the founder and CEO of the M Network and Jason is their creative director. The M Network is a full service branding, advertising, and strategic communications firm. They specialize in helping nonprofits, government agencies, funding agencies, grant-making organizations, and anyone else who is making a positive impact on the world. Tom, interestingly enough, started the company after a 20-year TV career, and frankly, with a pretty simple guiding principle and mantra, and it's one that, you know, if we could all make our mantra, the world would be a better place. He started this with the principle of, we can do anything, we choose to do good. Oh, and as Tom, by the way, we strip out the video so you can't see this. Right as I said this, Tom actually pointed to the wall, which I missed. The wall behind him says that choose to do good. I feel really silly for having missed that, but sure enough, they even write it on the wall there. Now, the M Network is based in Miami, Florida, and their work has been seen nationally and internationally. While you might not have heard of them, you have seen their work. And so if you've seen the CDC's Tips from Former Smoker campaigns, and trust me, if you've seen it, you remember it, you've seen their work. They have served nonprofits across the country. These are organizations that are working to end homelessness, help foster children, engage in child and family advocacy, and they've also helped funding organizations, primarily large community foundations across the country, get better at their marketing and their branding. Hey, Jason, Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I know in the work you do, you see a lot of logos. So I am hoping we can start today with a story about a nonprofit that either had a bad logo or a bad strategy for their logo.
You want me to start, Jason?
You probably got some good stories. I'll jump in there.
So we had we're not going to name any of our clients, but we work with a lot of nonprofits and foundations, and you know they have where they believe they have better things to spend their budget on than design work on a logo. We had a client walk in the door. They have the name of their organization, and the name of their organization has a tagline. So it's this charity where all children are awesome, whatever. And then they have an initiative, which is the Thrive by Five literacy program. So now you have a logo that says, our great organization where all children are awesome, Thrive by Five literacy program. And then they started a book club, and it was the, our great organization where all children are awesome, Thrive by Five literacy initiative, the Little Bookaroo book club. And then they wanted to put, like, it was just
powered by.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's a 32 word logo. We right. have to make work in branding.
It's the best of logos. It's the worst of logos.
Yeah.
And I get it. It sounds like instead of actually rethinking their logo or their strategy behind their logo, instead they just said, oh, let's tack something underneath it.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually, I think, a basic misunderstanding of what a logo is and what a logo is supposed to be doing. A lot of agencies, like this one, in fact, one, they viewed their organization as a house of brands rather than a branded house. In which case, you know, we're the big organization and every initiative has its own special name and its own special logo. And every initiative of that initiative has its own special name and its own special logo. Yeah, okay, that's how Unilever does it. You know, you've got Dove and, you know, Listerine and whatever else. But really, most nonprofits should be thinking of themselves as a branded house where everything falls under one umbrella. And yeah, it's not sexy and it's not cool. And you don't get to have that brainstorming session where you come up with a cool new name for every single initiative. But, you know, it's functional and people can remember it better.
Yeah. Consistency wins over that.
Right.
Type of
so, you know, I think, Jason, you know, when you were given that dissertation on these guys of why, what is a logo and what is it supposed to do?
Well, the hard part for me is people want a logo to do more than what a logo should actually do. You can't change a logo and all of a sudden change your branding, change your company, change how people receive you just because you've changed what you look like.
Right. And a logo really is for the people who already know you. A logo is not for people who don't know you. You're asking them, you're asking that little piece of information to do way too much. Brand is an emotional connection. It's not the look, it's not the font, it's not the colors, it's the emotional connection your audience has with you. And that logo doesn't convey that. It's not a promise, it's a reminder to people who've already experienced your organization of all the awesome stuff you do. So really, a logo is a very simple, quick, split-second reminder to the target audience of all of those great emotions that they have for you.
Right. It needs to convey much more than words, which is why a 32-word logo starts to look silly.
And doesn't work very well online or in your social media.
But it makes a council of 12 people designed by committee very happy with that.
Yeah.
Doesn't offend anyone. Everybody gets their say in there. But that's part of the point, is for forgetting that your organization serves the people. It's not for your personal choices. It's not about what you as a council member like personally. It's how that information is going to affect the people you serve. Do they get it? Do they like it? It has nothing to do about you.
You're not the target audience.
Right. So that's one of the hardest things they seem to forget in those types of meetings.
So I can totally buy into the fact that my logo is there to jog people's memory who already know me. Is there anything else I should be expecting on my logo?
Well, it's not going to do much heavy lifting, but it should be the emotional connection that everyone that is part of your audience is going to have with your brand. That's the one thing you can't really affect.
Yeah. In fact, if you start looking at it as more than that, that's when you start getting into trouble. When you start asking your logo to explain what your organization does, what products and services you offer, how many people work for you and your target audience, that's when you're going to get into real, real trouble. I mean, if you think about the greatest logos, right? They're all reductionist logos.
And getting smaller or getting more reduced,
well,
right?
You love the Starbucks logo.
Starbucks is great. I think Google's actually a good example as well.
Yeah, that's just a colorful G. Nike, the all-time favorite. They even removed the words. Now it's just a swoosh.
Well, FedEx is nothing but colors anymore.
Right.
Purple and orange.
McDonald's, you know that McDonald's red. As soon as you see it, that
different than
yellow,
Coca-Cola red, for sure.
Coca-Cola, would they just use the swoosh too? These are all awesome because they're just icons. It's just, you know, when you look at it and you get all that, oh yeah, I want a Starbucks right now.
Yeah.
We're gonna have to take a break. I need a Starbucks.
powered by.
Exactly. So I can hear my friends on my shoulder at small, medium-sized, even large nonprofits that are not iconic international businesses saying, okay, yeah, Starbucks International, IBM International, Google International, we're smaller than that. So what do we do so that our logo actually connects with people emotionally?
You make sure that your product and service is awesome. You make sure that you have all of the other communications options, both branding and marketing communications, out to your target audiences on a regular basis. You're connecting emotions to that logo. You make sure that logo, that icon, is on everything so that they're attaching their experiences with your product or service with that particular logo, that particular font, that particular color, and you do it over and over and over again. You know who's really, really much smaller than any of the clients that you have?
Who?
The homeless guy. Yet he stands there with a cardboard placard.
Great branding.
Yeah, it's fantastic. You know exactly, and unambiguous, you know exactly what he wants. He's at the same corner every single day.
The same brown sign or cardboard box sign.
Identical ask.
Markers, yeah.
Every single day. I mean, it's iconic. Homeless people are better at branding than most nonprofits. There's your takeaway. And it was nice being on your show. It's a shame we'll never be back.
I was going to say, I'm going to take a step back from that real quick. Yeah. But I think there's a really important point that you're tapping into there, which is that people with almost no privilege, like far, far less privilege than all the executive directors and marketing directors and development directors who might listen to this podcast, have figured out, okay, I need something that's iconic, that people are going to see and know exactly what it is I'm talking about. So I do think you're tapping into something really important there.
Yeah, I'm being a wise guy about it. But yes, that's the point, is that it doesn't take a lot of money to do this. It doesn't take a lot of effort to do this. In fact, I would gather to say that if we looked at 10 logos of your clients, we could do a reductionist exercise with Jason and probably make them all pretty good.
Much more social media ready, that's for sure.
Oh my gosh, wow. Yes. I mean, you think about that for a second, how much smaller the logo is. I mean, this is another problem when you have a lot of words and you reduce it down to that little tiny Instagram circle.
You have 32 pixels.
Nobody
by 32
that.
Pixels. That's it.
Yeah.
So when you say you do a reductionist exercise, what are some of the things you're reducing or taking out? Words, it sounds like.
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah, anything that doesn't communicate what we're looking to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, all of the words, there should only be one symbol, and it should be easily registered, like within a blink. You should be able to blink your eye and know, was it circle, was it square, what's the basic shape, and then a color palette. And it's got to be sort of a unique color palette. That's the other thing, is, you know, how many shades of blue and purple can nonprofits figure out how
right.
to... Right.
It's a little hard to stand out from the crowd in that case.
Yeah.
And admittedly, I do think that becomes the issue. Like the more simple your logo gets, the harder it is to stand out.
Well, yet the easier it does. If you look at the M Networks logo, we don't put it anywhere except our website. But there was this one of our clients was super nice, and they're a big performing arts venue. You would know it if we talked about it. And they decided that at their end of year gala, they wanted to thank us. And so they threw our logo in logo soup with everybody else's. And the first thing that people noticed was, why do we notice your logo so well versus everybody else's? And it's because it's so simple. I mean, there's not a lot to it. And there's no color to it. It's just a black M.
But it leaves people asking that question. I mean, the simplicity of it, of an M with one leg,
correct,
it's going to spawn the question. And that's going to make it more memorable.
Yeah, that's another thing that you could do with your logo. Is a logo is a great, if it's not for your target audience, if it's communicating, then why is your logo like that? Our logo is a M with one leg, but the shadow is the full M. I can't tell you how many people say, why does your logo only have one leg? What happened to the leg? Opens up a whole conversation, and there's a story behind it. We purposely designed our logo so that there's a story within the iconography of the logo.
So you can't tell me there's a story and not tell me the story. Sorry, Tom.
I don't think, I mean, I didn't know we were talking about us. So obviously the M Network is my last name, Mosloom. When I first started the company, I wanted to start a company that helped people who were helping other people. And it strikes me in all of my years in television and all of my journeys, you know, nobody really stands up on their own. Everybody needs help. And oftentimes you can't see the folks who are helping. You can't see the people who are holding up another person or holding up an organization. Every once in a while, if the light shines brightly enough on that organization, you could see those people in the shadows. And so we're the people in the shadows.
Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot. Now, did your logo start that way?
The logo has gone through...
Well, you've allowed me to refine it.
Yeah, 8 or 10 different iterations. But the basic structure of the logo, the one-legged M, the lack of a color palette, the shadow, that was all, that story was all there. The shadow has moved around over the
ages.
And
now we have a constant light source and we...
Yeah. We've changed the light source. We've moved the shadow around. We've made it three-dimensional. We've made it non-dimensional. I mean, we change the logo probably every 2 to 3 years.
Still an M. Still an M with one leg, though.
Exactly.
Because you know? I know that's one of the things you all really, really preach about is it, when you're changing your logo, make it evolution, not revolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless your logo sucks, in which case, you know.
Yeah.
No sense to involving that. Let's just make it good.
Yeah. So what does that evolution look like?
You want to talk about the foundation logo and how we did that exercise with them?
Yeah, for the Give Miami Day logo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we had reached a point where they had wanted to do like a revamp of the Give Miami Day logo. I believe they had used it for somewhere in the neighborhood of 8, maybe 9 years as it was. Mm-hmm. Part of their original branding from the Miami Foundation branding creation. So they wanted to actually, do you remember, was it to separate it or to pull it in as a... branded house?
They were trying to separate it out to allow for more...
To give it its own functionality.
Exactly.
I see. So a lot of that had to do with figuring out what worked, what is the consistent elements that the audience it recognizes. A lot of that has to do for Give Miami Day with the color, as well as the bold nature of their font. But changing the font so that it caught up to where they were now 8 or 10 years since they had created it, looking at a lot of the materials they had done, how they use typography, how they are using their colors, what's actually most effective, not just what they like. That has a lot to do with it. So from that, we broke down several different, I guess they're just stylescapes or art boards that laid out their color palette and kind of pieced the other aspects or the other sections of their organization within kind of, you know, those buckets so that when we got to the Give Miami Day, it made sense in context, as well as gave them the ability to kind of look at their organization and start to compartmentalize those aspects if that's what they really wanted to do. But the logo itself didn't change too much. I think we had a 10th anniversary edition. And then, as Tom always says, when you build a bridge to somewhere, like the anniversary, and you build the bridge and go to the other side, you shouldn't turn around and see the exact same thing. You should see something different. So after that 10th anniversary logo, we really had a good chance to revamp it and sort of bring it back into the house of brands with the Give Miami Day.
Yeah, and they're interesting because we got rid of all of the iconography and only left the typography.
Right, and the box, which is the icon of the entire organization, that's now part of the branding of the Give Miami Day. So you can't have a Give Miami Day without the visual iconography from the Miami Foundation.
Oh, wow. Okay, very cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
The Miami Foundation is 3 colors, 3 boxes, and Give Miami Day is just the highlight of the purple box.
Now, it sounds like the foundation started off as a house of brands. Is it still a house of brands?
Yes, it's kind of a house of brands. It's coming around. It's hard for organizations who are down the road, right? It's not a startup. We came in, you know, they celebrated. That's a 50-year-old organization. We've been with them for 10 or 12 of those years. That tells you how long these evolutions take, by the way. But it's hard for organizations that have long-standing initiatives that they have a name that they're married to say, okay, well, now how do we bring this back under the branded house moniker? It's been a slow process, but they're getting there. I mean, they are as close as they could be while still having special names for each of their initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to ask you then. So I'd be willing to bet the vast majority of nonprofits, even very small ones, like $500,000 budgets, find themselves having a house of brands. Like, oh, you know, this program, we call this, and it has a special color and a special logo. How do you help an organization move from, okay, we have five different brands that we're trying to support and keep alive, to we're going to have one brand that will thrive?
If they're a smaller organization and their footprint is small, then having all those different brands under your house is actually pulling away from both budget and time and energy. It is a soul suck on your, it's requiring of intervention style, you know, let's get you off the branded house model. But if you're a larger organization, it really is an evolution of just tinkering with the looks and bringing them into the umbrella look. And then starting to get rid of those names, all those different names, and bring them under the umbrella as well. There's no reason to have, you know, the Bookaroo Book Club. It doesn't need a name. It's the, here's our organization and this is our book club.
Yeah. Tom, I have to share with you, that reflects in my own experience. The consulting practice, we're a for-profit consulting practice, but I often compare us to a nonprofit because we look like a lot of small nonprofits. We have a couple W-2 employees. We have a few contractors. We serve a dozen to maybe 15 organizations a year. We're kind of like a small nonprofit or a small association. And when I first started the consulting practice back in 2014, I named it the Goldenberg Group. And then a couple years later, I started this podcast, the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. And a couple years after that, I was like, oh my God, I'm spending all this time and money on two brands, like literally two websites, two social, two everything. And at some point I was like, this just doesn't make sense. The Goldenberg Group is going to die. So, you know, so the entity with my name on it, I mean, technically we just changed the name, but still, you know, the entity with my name on it disappeared. I was like, no, we should just have one brand. But it's interesting because I didn't realize that until I found myself in that hamster wheel for a couple years of, okay, there's two websites, there's two, you know, like literally two of everything.
Yeah. And then you multiply that by however large your organization is, right? And so-and-so is in charge of that part of the organization and such is over there. And here's our program directors over there. And they've all done the same thing. And you go past 5-7 years and all of a sudden that organization has 10 other brands that it's serving. And it's just inefficient. It's inefficient. It's an inefficient use of money, and it competes for the attention of your target audiences.
Right. If I can add, I think it competes for the attention and the dollars for your target audience.
Of course.
When your organization sends out its main appeals under its name, people will not think, oh, you know, I know that organization, because that's not the organization they interact with.
Yeah. No, it's the program. And large funding agencies are notorious for this. There's a bunch of different services councils throughout the United States where, they receive federal grants or state grants, and they fund a lot of different things. And the target audience, we've done public opinion research on this with our research partners, where we say, what is your name recognition of this organization? And it's super low. And then we say, what is your name recognition of this program? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we know them. They're awesome. And it's, it's so self-defeating. Because the reality is there. You're doing great work. But you're not getting credit for it. Only your program is. And so when it comes down to getting those dollars back in the house, that's a tough ask.
Yeah. So let me ask you that question. When you're an organization and you have a corporate name, but you have one program that everyone knows and almost no one knows your corporate name, do you recommend that organizations consider changing their name to the entity everyone knows, or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to look at the organization. In theory, you say, well, what does everybody know us for? Let's just call us that. If that's where all of our traction is, then, you know, that's what we are. At the end of the day, though, your organization is whatever your target audience calls it. And I'm sorry about that. And the services that you provide, no matter how erudite you want to give them a title, they are exactly what your audience calls them. And we do early education organizations throughout the country, and they don't like the word daycare. They'll settle for the word childcare, but they want to be called early education. Yet nobody picks their kid up at the early education center. It just doesn't happen.
So how do you help your clients move past that? You know, your clients are going, no, we want this to be called the Early Education Center. And you're thinking, everyone calls you the daycare center, or, you know, maybe pre-K.
Yeah, I think nothing, and we're getting a far afield of logos, but nothing really clarifies that point like public opinion research. When you go and you interview a good cross-section of the human beings that live in your community and you ask them, this service, what do you call it? And, you know, 94% call it some combination of childcare, daycare, or pre-K. And only the people who actually work in the industry call it early education. Then you say, okay, well, here, what would you like to do about that? Listen, I could change their minds. We could spend $14 million next year on an education campaign that informs your target audience that it's now called early education. Or I could spend, you know, a fraction of that redoing your letterhead. Where do you want to go with that?
Admittedly, that's a compelling argument. That's a very, very compelling argument.
Yeah, it's hard though. It's hard.
Jason, you're looking like you want to jump in, but I can't tell.
Well, we have a client that had a similar situation where they had a lot of programs. No one knew it was, they had a lot of programs and nobody knew it was them who's funding all of those programs. So we had to start our branding, and how we're going to do that is to take all of the logos, make them subservient to the main branded logo, take some of the branding that we have from that organization and find a way to replicate it in the new branding that we're trying to do to incorporate so that people can understand at least the logo is on the ad from that organization. And just that amount of repetition starts to kind of balance things off a little bit, at least branding wise. I mean, there's only so much you can do, but.
Yeah. And so many of these organizations take the attitude and you have to go to the board and you have to talk to them, but it's the attitude of every dollar we spend on that is a dollar that we're not spending on services. And, you know, I'm massively sensitive to that. And I know Jason is.
Well, that reminds me of what we talked about the other day. Good design might be expensive, but bad design is going to cost you much more.
It is. It is. There's, you know, these same organizations are spending so much time, so much manpower, so much effort servicing all of these different brands that are sub brands. That's really sucking the efficacy and dollars out of the organization's communications budget. And so, you know, I know it's a hard sell. I know it doesn't sit well, but when you see the evidence, when you see the actual dollars, cents, and public opinion research, it's hard to escape those conclusions.
So I'll share with you, one of the things I love about the podcast is we might start off talking about one thing like logos and end up on an incredibly good conversation. Because to me, like, this feels really impactful. This sense of, hey, you know, if you're one of my friends who's listening and, you know, and you're like, oh yeah, we're a house of brands. Maybe part of the call from this episode is, you know, become a, what do you say, a branded house?
Yeah, it's one house, one brand, everything's inside of there. It falls under the same roof, as opposed to a house of brands where underneath that house are all these different brands and they're all their own thing, right? You have this, the whole house is branded in a branded house. The house of brands is all these things running around. And it's, I mean, there's reasons to do that. If you're Unilever, yes, you want to do that. If you're General Electric, yes, I totally see it.
General Mills.
Exactly. Right. And I think the other thing that should be maybe a takeaway is, you know, whether it's formal or informal, do some research on this stuff. Go ask members of your target audience, what do you call it? What do you think? I mean, if you walked into a restaurant and the waiter walked up and said, here's your steak, like, I'd have to say I'm allergic to steak. I mean, it would be presumptuous, right? Like, why our organizations do that. We don't go out and show the menu of options and say, okay, let's talk about our marketing. Let's talk with our loyal customers about what would be helpful for you.
I mean, how is that best done? Are those the informal conversations, the online survey, the focus group, all of the above?
I'm a huge fan of scientific research. It adds a layer of known quantity. Like, I know it's going to succeed. I know that this message, I know that these colors, I know that this is going to work. It takes a lot of guesswork out. If you're going to spend $50,000 on a campaign next year that doesn't work, maybe you should spend $10,000 on some public opinion research before you ever take it. And maybe they'll say, no, that's not going to work. And you could spike it. I just saved you $40,000. Like, and I know a lot of smaller organizations don't have that, but they all have mouths and they all have human beings that love them and want them to succeed. So you could do it informally. The data won't be as rich, but at least you'll have something. And the biggest mistake folks make is, what, I know my target audience. I know what they want. No, please don't do that. Please love your target audience more than that.
Right. Yeah. It's not your brand anyways. They tell you what your brand is.
So we've gone on an interesting journey from logos to, hey, let's talk about brand and let's talk about being a branded house instead of a house of brands. I now want us to take the next step, which is the fun game of the podcast, Two Truths and a Lie. Which of you all wants to go first? And just a quick reminder, you're going to tell me two truths and one lie. You aren't going to tell me which one's the truth or which one's the lie.
I just can't wait to hear what Tom's are going to be.
He's lived such are these personal truths or just marketing truths? Is there a box that we put this in, or is it the field wide open? Two truths and a lie. Okay. My first job in television was as a reporter, and I was only 16 years old. I once pole vaulted 16 feet. And I have three dogs. They all have the same name.
At first, I was hoping the number 16 was going to run through all three, and it didn't.
So, No. You know, I should have said four dogs. Four dogs, they all have the same name, because then you'd have 16 legs. But no, I wasn't thinking
enough. He's creating a theme here. Okay, so I do think your first job on air was at 16. I think it would be unusual to have four dogs all with the same name, unless you are getting rescues or something like that. And I could see in a prior life you maybe pole vaulting. But I'm gonna say you don't have three dogs all with the same name.
You are correct. That is a lie.
I finally got one right. Hallelujah.
Wait, you're going to play the same game, right? You have to tell us when he's done. You have to give us two lies and two truths and a lie.
I can try. I can certainly try. I am curious, though. How did you get your first on-air job at 16?
Oh, so it was like 1984. And, I had lied my way into a job at a golf course. I told him I was 15 at the time. I told him I was 16. And I was driving a tractor, mowing the roughs, and I hated that job. I was driving that tractor 8 hours a day thinking to myself, I have got to get an education. I am going to be smarter than this. I can't do this. I'm not cut out for this. So I got fired from that job, and that was a blessing. And then I rode my bike up to the TV station, and I kept hounding the news director because I thought he ran the place. I didn't realize it had a GM. And I finally met with him, a guy named Bill Van Pelt. He started my career. And I said, look, I'll get your coffee. I'll mop the floors. I'll do whatever you want. Let me hang around. And he heard my voice, which has always been this deep. And he said, follow me. And we walked down the halls and the doors to the studio opened. And it was like magic. It was like you hear the choir. Oh, I mean, I was home. That was it. And he had me sit in the set and he said, pick up one of those newspapers and read it. So I started reading. And then he said, no, out loud, dummy. And so I read it out loud. And then the teleprompter came on and he said, read this. And he said, hey, I got an idea. It would be really great if we had an education reporter reporting on the Board of Education in this town who was actually part of the education system. How'd you like the job? And I'll teach you how to report. And I said, yes, sir. I went and told my dad. My dad, of course, thought I was lying. So I had to call Bill, and Bill called my dad, and they had a long conversation and set parameters and all of that other stuff. So that's how I started. That was it.
That is not at all the story I thought it was going to be. That's awesome. Yep. That is doubly awesome.
My favorite part of the story was you riding your bike to the job. That's the most unexpected.
He wasn't 16 yet. He didn't have a driver's license.
That's true.
He was willing to lie about his age, but not drive.
The ticket costs more than the fib.
Okay, Jason, two truths and a lie.
See if I can come up with some here. All right. I trained with the number 3 ranked sword fighter in the world. I have survived a skydiving accident. And I have dove cage-free with sharks.
Okay.
Tom doesn't know which one is the lot.
So well, you say it with such conviction, they're probably all true. And knowing you as I do, they're all plausible.
True.
So I know you've done kung fu and capoeira. I don't think there's any swords in capoeira. I don't know about kung fu. Don't know enough about it. But I'm going to guess that's true. So now I'm down to cage-free diving with sharks or a skydiving accident. And it could not have been that serious of one because you're alive today.
Correct.
So I'm going to guess that you did not have a skydiving accident.
That's correct.
Woo, yeah, I never get this right. Oh,
good.
My gosh.
All right, it's your turn.
Okay. Let's see. I have been to every continent except Australia and Antarctica. And when I say been, that means slept a night. I am a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and I can't swim.
So I'm going to say the continent thing is correct, and it would be so odd if he knew Brazilian jiu-jitsu, wouldn't it?
It would be, but I'm thinking he can swim.
So you're going with the lie is the...
The can't swim. The That's can't what swimming. I believe.
All right, I'm going to go with the Brazilian jiu-jitsu as the lie.
Okay.
So do you want to bet something on it? Funny? We'll it I just
we're both wrong.
There's no point to bet. Here's why. I just realized I played the game wrong. I told you 3 truths.
They're all true?
I am so sorry. I was trying to say, yeah, in my head, I'm like, I was trying to make the continent thing a lie, but it turns out I said the truth. Oh my gosh, I'm terrible.
Where do you live that you can't swim?
So I live in Georgia. And let me say, I have a different definition of swimming than most people. So, you know, so I can swim across a pool.
Okay.
But if you dropped me half a mile from shore with no life preserver, I mean, I would know that would be the day I would die.
I think most people a half mile out. Tom and I were both lifeguards through a lot of our youth, right? A half mile out, yeah.
That's a good distance. It takes a good swimmer.
Yeah, see, I'm married to an Ironman, so I have a different definition of swimming, I guess. Because honestly, if you drop me a quarter of a mile out, I would not make it back. Like I already know that. Like I would not make it back. Like once I'm in water over my head, I don't feel so good anymore. I don't feel so comfortable.
That's your discomfort level. You know, you float, right?
Most people can. I can't.
Really? That's going to be on your list. Your list of next time you play this game, you have to say one of your truths is I can't float.
And by the way, Tom, people even like, oh, well, in salt water. No, in salt water, I still sink.
That's great. No, this has to be part of your litany of things now. I can't float. Yeah. Needs to be one. Everybody's picking that one. Everybody floats.
Or maybe my next one will be, I clearly don't know how to play 2 truths and a lie. I told you
absolutely.
All
3 These are facts.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you so much, Tom, Jason, thank you for coming on. I know you all do a ton of work with nonprofits and social startups, because obviously you choose to do good, as it's written behind you on the wall. You choose to do good in this world. And so friends, if you want to reach out to Tom or Jason, all you have to do is go to m.network. By the way, I learned something new. There's a new .com in town and it's .network. So you can go to m.network. And one of the best reasons to go there is they use their website as a testing ground or a proving ground. So when they're thinking, hey, let's try something a little unusual with our content, they try it there first. And then if it's a good idea, they export it to their clients. So if you visit their website, I actually went there and did it again today, you will get a glimpse at some of the experiments that they are making. So if you're curious to see what the people on the cutting edge are doing, make sure you go to m.network. Also, while you were there, there are 2 really good blog posts that you could check out. One is A Word About Logos, and the other is Nonprofits Have the Worst Logos. We are going to link to both of those in our show notes at successfulnonprofits.com. Hey, Tom, Jason, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, our pleasure. Anytime, man.
Thank you.
It was fun.
All right, friends, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode. And just as a quick reminder, this is a good opportunity for you to think about, are we a branded house or a house of brands? And if you are one of those nonprofits that has 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 brands underneath it, and you're interested in maybe making a change, think today about what the next step would be to start to become that branded house. And if you liked today's episode, if it got you thinking about your logo and about your brand, there's two others you should listen to. One is episode 249, Crafting Your Brand with Amanda Ross. Obviously, we talked a good little bit about logos today, but logos aren't brands. So make sure you check out episode 249. Also, episode 241, Content Marketing Gold with Rick Smith. We did not talk a lot about content marketing, but let's face it, if you're talking about branding, you're probably talking about content marketing as well. That, friends, is our show for the week. I hope that you've gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And you know, the lawyers make me say it, and if I don't, they're going to drop me half a mile offshore. Without a boat, let me be clear. So I'm not an accountant nor an attorney, and neither I nor the consulting practice provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. I say this every week, so hopefully you remember this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied on for tax, legal, or accounting advice. Please, if that is what you need, find a licensed, qualified person in your area.